You're listening to the PES on KZUU 90.7 FM, broadcasting live from the dark, damp dungeons of Smith Gym. KZUU is made possible in part by Heroes in Sports, located at 245 Northeast Kamiokan Street. Pullman's Hometown Deli offers a variety of sandwiches, salads, and soups, with catering available. More information can be found by calling Heroes in Sports 509-334-5423. Had a bad weekend? Need legal counseling? Student Legal Services at WSU is happy to help. Student Legal Services is a student-run organization that provides free legal advice to students. So if you'd like their help, stop by their office in Ann Edix, room 305. They're open Monday through Thursday, 9 to 5, and Friday, 9 to 1. Speaking of the Ann Edix, that building's getting torn down. Because I guess more important than academic space is, of course, green space. Speaking Japanese, if you please, learn Japanese for free. Everyone is welcome to join in the good times at Neal Public Library every Tuesday. Beginners can learn about Japanese culture, basic speaking and writing skills from 4:30 to 5:15 p.m. Intermediate students will focus on grammar and vocabulary from 5:15 to 6 p.m. And the advanced class with one-on-one teaching meets at 5:30 to 6:15 p.m. Contact Kimi Hiroshi at 509-432-3903 or the Neal Public Library at 334-3595 for more information. Alrighty, so we missed last week due to the fact that we were celebrating spring break. Alright, hopefully everybody had a lot of fun and got the partying out of their system, because we are now in the final stretch of the WSU semester. The finish line is visible from where we're at, and it's just a sprint to the end. What comes between now and then that is important is softball. And softball will be starting up here real shortly, too. Sign-ups are going to be Tuesday and Wednesday. Try to put a couple men's teams together, get on out there, play some softball. The more, the merrier. So I just want to have more options of teams that we're going to beat this year. That's right. My team will go all the way, as we always do, because we are just that good. Come out and see us. Come out and play against us. Put a team together and see for yourself. The favorite of the PES, the Reverend, Reverend Horton Heat. Reach us on the telephone at 509-335-2207, on the web at www.kzuu.org, and on our show's website, www.thepes.com. Well, so many things to talk about with having a week off. And just so you're wondering, if you're wondering, the co-host, Tom, is taking his two-week spring break because he's just an overachiever. And except when he's running that marathon, he only goes half a marathon, so I guess it all balances out. Overachieve on some, underachieve on others. So today's Daily Evergreen, there's a letter to the editor by Ryan Schindler, and I really like the first paragraph, so I thought I'd share it. And in this, he's talking about the article that appeared in the Evergreen recently, and he said, an article that pondered a recent surge in violence at WSU claimed the Greek community often bears the most visible blame. I know it's not exactly politically correct to constantly blame the Greek system, but eventually you have to look at the facts. Greeks are being blamed for a reason, not surprisingly, because they are the source of the most violence on and around campus. Look at the police logs from February, and you will find most entries involve alcohol or the main supplier of the alcohol, the Greek community. Now, I don't necessarily agree with this last part, but I really thought it was sort of funny how he pointed out the, look at the facts. They are responsible for it. And what's really funny, I think, about this whole thing is he probably has a whole bunch of people in the Greek system right now really riled up, and they're probably going to go and hunt them down and beat them up to show them they're not violent. Okay. So this website, palousatix.com, www.palousatix, palousitics.com. It'd be sort of like politics and palouse put together. It's run by Tom Forbes. And in here, he always has great articles, great editorials, great comments and whatnot. And there's a couple that I just wanted to share with everybody today. I'm sure you can go to the website yourself and read these for yourself. But for those who aren't anywhere near a computer, and if you're driving down the road right now, I certainly hope you're not surfing the web. But there is a letter to the editor from, it's in the Daily, the Pullman Moscow Daily News. And in it, a man says this. A while back, a young man wrote that it is no big deal driving to Moscow to shop. Actually, I can't see the difference in driving to Moscow or almost to Moscow to shop. It is a big deal, and I'm still hoping for a Pullman Walmart. It started the year of my 80th birthday. Our elected officials gave Walmart the go-ahead to build on Bishop Boulevard. Later, I attended meetings when the Spokane judge ruled it okay. Now, my 85th birthday is coming. What's the holdup? And it's funny, if you look at that, you know, essentially he's saying in 5 years, we still don't have a Walmart that we should be able to have. And it's all been held up for all these years by mainly a group called the Pullman Alliance for Responsible Development, PARD. And it's been argued over and over and over again that they're not necessarily for or against development. They're against Walmart. And it's easier to get a large area of support under you if you try to claim that you're a huge organization about all development versus a anti-Walmart only group, because over the years they've really only ever tried to stop one development, where they have members have written in about other developments they didn't like, but the group itself never went against any of these other developments. As a matter of fact, I'm surprised they're not going against WSU right now, saying, hey, you know, this new conference center and hotel you want to put in on campus is probably not a good idea, because you are going to be hurting our local businesses. Our local businesses already put in a conference center. Now you're going to compete with them head-to-head. We already have a lot of hotels, so you're going to compete with those head-to-head. And why is our local grassroots organization that's looking out for the little people in downtown Pullman that don't want the Walmart to come in, but all of a sudden, when it comes to WSU doing something, oh, let's just turn our head and pretend it's not happening. Well, the problem is that it's not about responsible development in Pullman. It's about not liking Walmart. If you have evidence to the contrary, you can call me up and we'll discuss it, 335-2207, but I believe I'm correct about this. Anyway, what's interesting is if you think about the WSU freshmen this year, they were in middle school when this was going to come out, when the first inkling of a Walmart coming to Pullman was even there. And now here they are 5 years later in college, and we still don't have the Walmart. We're still forcing them to take their money and go to Moscow to spend it. Yes, drive. Drive those 8 miles. Go to Walmart in Moscow. Go to Shopko in Moscow. Or excuse me, go to Winco in Moscow. Go to the mall in Moscow. Go do all your shopping in Moscow. After all, we are a community. And even though Pullman gets no benefit out of that money that you decide to spend across the border, we're a community and we ought to feel good about the fact we're keeping it local. Even though keeping it local doesn't do a darn thing to help us in Pullman with our streets, with our libraries, with our parks. It doesn't help us at all when you go spend your money across the border. But we're supposed to believe that it's all good because, hey, you know, it's all local. It's all local. We're all one community here. We shouldn't try to compete against one another. Well, of course, we're not going to compete against one another because there's no competition out there. It's Pullman and Moscow. And Moscow has all the businesses. Pullman has very few. Therefore, when it comes to spending any copious quantities of money, it's going to be... it is going to be spent in Moscow. Let's see here. Also, this is another interesting thing. Walgreens is going to be going into Moscow. So, the smart growth... let me just read straight how Tom has it written up here. It goes, more smart growth, in quotes, in Moscow. Despite Queen Nancy's objections to chain retail in the corridor ruining our quote-unquote small-town charm, wasting our water and not providing living wage jobs, and destroying the local businesses that are sustainable and don't, quote-unquote, siphon money out of the community, a third major national retailer is locating in Moscow on her watch. This time, it's Walgreens. Where are the petitions? Where are the angry ponytailed mobs? The environmentally friendly torches? The non-aggressive pitchforks? Where's the concern over the poor locally owned Hodgen drugs? So, and essentially, the Walgreens is going in the place where there used to be a hotel, the Mark IV Motor Inn, which was before that the America Best Value Inn. That's going to get torn down, and they're going to be putting in a Walgreens. It looks like it will be a 14,800 square foot store with 45 parking spaces for vehicles. And so they're going to be going in and competing with the local businesses, but that's okay. Because Walgreens is not Walmart. And as long as it's not Walmart, and, you know, Moscow already has a Walmart. They don't really mind having the one because they already got it. But they really don't want to have a second one, I suppose. They fought against the Super Walmart idea. And now I've heard ground rumors, and I don't think there's any truth to it, but I've heard that Walmart was talking about, well, not building in Pullman at all, but going out to this new Hawkins development, which really would hurt in a lot of ways, because having that in the city limits of Pullman will mean that Pullman will get a large amount of tax revenue that goes out into the corridor. Whitman County gets the revenue. Now, I'm not against Whitman County getting revenue, because the county itself does need revenue. But the city of Pullman won't have the benefit of this Walmart that we've been hoping for years. Almost 5 years now. Think about in the last 5 years the kinds of things that we could have done with that money. Maybe we wouldn't Daily Evergreen, tie this back in here in a second, the Daily Evergreen has a letter to the editor today by Kyle Dorsey, 1981 alum of WSU. In it, he is telling the Graduate Student Association that he was disappointed in their voting of no on the Pullman Transit, $15 a year or semester fee. I believe it's a semester. And in it, he's pretty much points out that, gosh, you know, you go without one half rack of beer and pizza once, and you've now paid for it. And he says, you know, I understand there's a lot of taxes, a lot of fees, but going to school ain't a cheap thing. It is sort of expensive. So therefore, he's disappointed with them. And I'm just sort of wondering if maybe we had a Walmart in the last 5 years, would this $15 vote even have come up? Or would it maybe have been $5? Or maybe not at all. Who knows? Maybe the streets and the parks that we have in Pullman would be two times better than they currently are. Three times better than they currently are. Some of our walking paths might be totally completed. Maybe we'd have more walking paths. Maybe we would have a couple more parks. Or maybe the parks that we do have would be upgraded. The city playfields are all great and everything like that, but I'll tell you what, sliding on the dirt there is like sliding on sandpaper. Once you do it, you got an open wound that will not heal for the rest of the season, because every time you slide, it reopens. The lighting on those fields, the light poles are so short that any kind of pop-up actually can get out of the lights and the outfielders lose it, and it can be actually relatively dangerous. There's just so many things that could be done with money driven through retail within the city of Pullman that we are missing out on, because we have a small, well-funded group of people who are doing everything in their power to keep retail out of Pullman. One specific retailer. And it was interesting, because I was with a group of people just recently, and we were driving down Bishop and Grand Avenue, and they were talking about all the strip malls that have been built recently, and they were talking about how, wow, it's sort of weird, they have all these strip malls, but really very few of them have many tenants. You know, like this one has one tenant, this one has two tenants. There's so many empty spaces, and they keep building more. Why do they do such a thing? It seems wasteful to them. Well, what they realize is the overall grand scheme of things. The reason why these places are getting built is because we know that when the flypaper is attached, the flies will come. And what's going to happen is when this Walmart gets built, and I believe it's still going to get built here in the city of Pullman, pretty soon all these other businesses are going to fill in, and pretty soon all these other places will have some small businesses in them. So it's going to be all good and everything like that, but it's going to take a little bit of time. But in the meantime, they have the spots for it. All they need now is the flypaper. And another interesting thing pointed out in Palooza Ticks today was there's another article in the Daily News talking about the Pullman School District. They're looking at either needing to remodel or replace the high school. Well, the hard part about that is that they just did that with Lincoln Middle School a couple years back, and the city taxpayers footed a big levy for it. And or I guess the bonds. But anyway, we're still paying that off, and now we're being told, well, we need a new high school. The high school that was built was actually, I guess, designed by a prison designer. And it's a very uniquely designed place. It's very sprawling. Ooh, there's the sprawl word. So I guess everybody in PARD would be totally for this if we got rid of the sprawling high school. The problem, though, is that there's a lot of space in the school that's not being well utilized. That by remodeling the school, they could utilize a lot of this space that's not being currently utilized very well. Or if you totally rebuild the school, then you could build it, more school-like, a little bit better. So these people are talking between $53 and $55 million to get this done. Well, according to the Palooza Ticks website, this is pretty interesting. It says, pay close attention to this line in the story below. Quote, funding will become easier as property valuations in Pullman increase, end quote. Both the Pullman Walmart Supercenter and the Hawkins development in the corridor will be in the Pullman School District number 267 taxing district. Walmart's property, valued at $22,784,646, will pay $112,784, so about $113,000 a year in taxes to the Pullman School District just by the Walmart property alone. The Hawkins development, at a 40% build-out, so not even the full size, just 40% of the size, is going to be valued at $50 million, twice that of what Walmart will be valued at 40%. So if you carry those numbers on, you're talking about $100 million place, $110 million place. And you carry the numbers out, so the Hawkins development will be paying $247,500 in taxes, almost $250,000 at 40%. So you're talking about $500,000 to $600,000 a year when it's fully built out by Hawkins. Another $113,000 from Walmart. We're talking $600,000 to $700,000 a year to the Pullman School District just by property tax valuations. The additional $72,784,646, that's the Hawkins and the Walmart added together, in property valuation added to the tax rolls, bringing in an extra $360,284, so essentially $360,000 a year to our local schools. As a homeowner and a parent of a preschooler who may very well benefit from a new Pullman High School, you can see why I'm supporting Walmart and Hawkins versus sending my dollars to the Idaho school systems. Essentially, rather than going to Moscow and spending my money there, giving their schools better money and giving their streets and towns all better money, even if we get certain businesses, that's not going to mean we are stopping our money flow going to Moscow. They're still going to be getting our money. They still have a lot of stores we're not going to have. They're still going to have the Old Navy and the Bed Bath & Beyond and the Macy's and the Hastings. They're going to have all those stores, but there's going to be certain staples that are going to be able to be purchased in Pullman from the Walmart. You're going to be able to go and get your shampoo and boxes and DVDs and certain electronics from right here in Pullman. And those monies will stay local. Those taxes will stay local. Those people who are employed will then get money to turn around and spend at other businesses. They one thing Pardot always tries to argue is that, well, you know, by supporting places like Walmart, you're going to send all of our money over out of town because, you know, it's based somewhere else. Sure, some money's going to go out of town because, hey, those people are getting money. But, you know, when any local retailer buys products, they're not buying them from local places. They're buying them from out-of-town places. And that money that they spend to buy those products are going out of town. But the one thing that Pard doesn't really seem to want to acknowledge is the fact that even though money is going to be going out of town for all sorts of various reasons, not just because it's a national retailer, there's going to be a lot of money that stays local, because what's going to happen is you're going to have all sorts of employers or employees who are getting money. And that money that they get is going to be spent at the local pizza places, at the local grocery stores, at the local other local restaurants. And that money is going to be spent in all sorts of different places locally, plus over in Moscow, plus when they go to Spokane or back to Seattle or wherever they're going to be going for the time, or purchasing stuff off the internet. But that money that we're spending goes into the employees who then go out and spend the money, and then those employees of those other places get money and they go out and spend money. So it's not like every dollar that you spend in Walmart is going to be 100% taken out of the area. That's just not true. Not only that, look at the fact that, okay, so let's pretend, no, just for a second, what we'll do is we'll say, okay, let's look at a local store. Let's say Dismore's. Locally owned, right? Locally, all that kind of stuff. How much of the money that we spend at Dismore's on a weekly basis, how much of that actually stays in Pullman? How much of that is being spent on shipping? How much of that is being spent paying for the, let's say, all the General Mills products? Do you think that all the General Mills products are made in Pullman and all that money stays local? No, a large amount of that money that we're spending there is being flushed out of Pullman. Just because the owners are local doesn't mean that all money stays local. And even though those are the arguments that are attempted to be made from time to time by certain people, not a very fair argument to make, for sure. Anyway, let's hear one more from the Reverend. When I come back, I got a couple other items I'd like to speak about. The favorite of the PES, the Reverend, Reverend Horton Heat, on the telephone with me, the one and only Tom Forbes. Tom, how are we doing today?
I'm good. How are you, Scotty?
Doing great. So, I was just talking to everybody about this one website, www.palusatix.com. Have you ever heard of that one?
I think I have.
You have? Okay, great. Wonderful website. And we were talking about the costs of a new Pullman High School. And let me just ask you, what are your thoughts about that? Would you rather see the current school? I did sort of mention how the current school is sort of a sprawling school, and I suppose that's a bad word to use, but...
Yeah, it's... you know, I have a daughter who's going to Pullman High School now, and so I've had the opportunity to you know, go around and sit in the classrooms for, you know, teacher meetings and tours and things like that. And it is a very, very confusing layout. I'm not sure who the school was designed by. It's almost designed like one of those mazes that rats run through in experiments. It's very, very, very unusual design. I mean, I thought that I went, you know, the high school that I went to in the late 70s was brand new, and we always used to make fun of it because the windows were like arrow slits, and there was a fence, or it kind of looked like a penitentiary from the outside, and so we always used to laugh at the design, but on the inside it was a relatively standard design. The Pullman High School design is very, you know, the rooms are kind of circular, and the ceilings are sloping, and there's not like a straight angle, you know, anywhere in the whole school almost. It's like the rooms are very, you know, the classrooms are very unusually shaped, and the space is not used very effectively. And so, yeah, I'm not really sure what they could do with it as far as remodeling goes. It would be, I'm sure that's why the remodel is probably priced out as expensive as the as building a brand new one, because, you know, they probably have to tear so much down to make the existing school work. It would be probably just as much, or just as effective to build a new one.
So here's what I'm sort of curious about is, you know, I know Lincoln Middle School a couple years ago was torn down and totally rebuilt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the only thing left over is like, they left like, to get away with calling it a quote unquote remodel, they like left one. I think it was the gym or something they left in place, but everything else was torn down. So it's kind of semantics.
Okay, so I'm just sort of curious, if they were to totally rebuild the high school, I would assume that they'd probably stay at the same location. They would just tear down the existing building and rebuild there.
Yeah, because that's what they did with Lincoln. You know, they left kind of the old heart in action, and you know, and again, my daughter was there for just the tail end of that. You know, luckily she missed out on the major renovations, but I think they had brought in like trailers and stuff to accommodate classrooms for a while. And
okay,
but they made it work. I mean, it was kind of a mess for a couple of years, but they did make it work.
So essentially, so they didn't necessarily tear down the whole thing at once. They
put
it in sections.
No. Yeah, and I would imagine if they did either a rebuild or a completely new structure, they would probably have to do something similar at the high school.
Yeah, that would make sense. So as a City of Pullman resident, taxpayer, and worker in the City of Pullman, what are your thoughts about this, Tom? Do you want to see a new high school? Do you want to see a renovated high school?
Well, I think eventually we're going to have a new one. I think one of the quotes in the newspaper article from, I think it was Tom Rockefeller, the chief of the school board, you know, the superintendent of the school board, you know, basically was, you know, people in Pullman expect a certain level of service from the school systems here. You know, we're not a standard rural community, you know, compared to even Moscow, really. I mean, Moscow's high school, I mean, you know, they've been, you know the story, of course, you know, with the school levies in Moscow and the controversy that's recently erupted over that, you know, with Jerry White's filing suit against the district. And, you know, Moscow's high school is much, much older than Pullman's high school. I think their high school dates from back in the 40s or 50s or something like that. It's much, and in general, all of their schools in Moscow are, you know, considerably older than the equivalent schools in Pullman. Because you look now, you know, Lincoln, with Lincoln's renovation, every elementary school and middle school in Pullman, or the middle school in Pullman, you know, has either been renovated or built since the mid-90s. So we have except for Pullman High School.
Right, I was going to say.
We have a very new, very modern, building system here. And so, and again, I think that's because we're a little bit different than a rural community. And most of the children that attend, you know, Pullman Public Schools are, for the most part, the children of college students. They're the children of, you know, college faculty. Or, you know, for the children that work here at SEL, you know, their parents are, you know, engineers or computer programmers or other professionals. So I think people's expectations for their kids are considerably heightened, you know, versus maybe, say, like people in Colfax.
Sure.
And so I think he was right about that. I think people, you know, we pay a lot of taxes here in Pullman. We pay a lot of property tax. And so justifiably, I think people want to see that reflected in the school system.
So,
and generally speaking, people have always been willing to open up their wallets. You know, the recent levy, the maintenance and operations levy, passed by, I think it was a 78% margin. You know, well over the 60% requirement. Or now, I guess that's got knocked down to just a simple majority.
Which I'm not for that personally.
I'm not either, but you know,
I mean,
it wouldn't matter because, you know, the people in Pullman, for the most part, it took a while to get the Lincoln bond through. You know, people aren't just going to blindly sign up. You know, they're not going to write a blank check to the school district, the Lincoln,
right. And that was
Lincoln
right at the same time as the hospital too.
Before they really got, you know, they had to get the price down to what people thought was reasonable.
Which I think is appropriate. You go before the people say,
and
this is what
that
we
can
want.
Happen with the high school too. People might think that $55 million is a bit on the pricey side, and so they might, you know, might take a few shots at the bond for the high school if they come in at $55 million. They might have to knock the price back and maybe take a few bells and whistles off. But in general, people in Pullman are extremely supportive of the public schools, and with good reason. We have an excellent public education system in Pullman. For again, for a town this size, when you look at the test scores, the sports programs, everything across the line, it's a very quality system for the size of town that we have. So, however, as you know, if you're a homeowner in this town, we're maxed out on property taxes. You know, the county, which assesses property taxes through the city. They cannot legally have any more property taxes on us than we have right now. We're at the legal maximum on property taxes. So, as a homeowner, if there's anything that we can do to increase property tax valuation in Pullman and the surrounding area without having to stick it to the homeowners and still maintain that quality of education, I'm all for it. And that's why, you know, I said I was, you know, strongly in support of the Walmart project and the Hawkins project because that'll do that. You know, the thing about it is people often forget. This is a very often overlooked and forgotten fact of all of these wonderful, brand new, multi-million-dollar buildings that go in on the WSU campus, like the new Cub, the new plant biosciences building, which is rapidly going up every day. All of those multi-million-dollar buildings return $0 to the Pullman School District. They're completely exempt because their state-owned properties are completely exempt from property taxes. So it's wonderful that we have all those great new things coming. The new conference center that they're talking about, the golf course, all of that stuff, worth tens of millions of dollars in property tax valuation, nothing, pay zero taxes. And that's not a slam on WSU. It's just a simple fact roughly 40% of the town is comprised of the university and is exempt from property tax. So we really don't have a huge property tax base to draw from like a lot of other places would.
Right.
We don't have a lot of industry, and we certainly don't have a lot of retail to pay property tax either. And that is in Washington. How public schools get funded is through property taxes.
So what we really need to do is we just need to have more valuation, not additional taxes, and that's what Walmart
right.
would do.
Sure.
According to Politics.com, the Pullman Walmart would bring in just over $22 million in valuation,
right?
Which would then give us, I believe it said, $130,000 a year in taxes.
Right. But that's just property taxes. That has nothing to do with sales at all. The store could sell $0, and they would still have to pay, you know, $130,000 a year would go to the school system for property taxes. That's just the valuation of the property and the buildings.
Exactly. So that in of itself would be great. And then as you've also pointed out, the Hawkins development, though it's not in the city limits, is part of the school district
right.
area.
Right, because it's just part of this eastern part of Whitman County. Because the children, you know, the children from, like Albion, for example, Albion is not in Pullman, and yet the children of Albion go to Pullman schools.
So people in Albion actually pay taxes towards Pullman schools then?
On their property taxes.
On their property.
Yes.
And then, likewise, people who live out in the county, people live out there on Airport Road, those
right,
houses.
Right, the people that live out that way, their children go to Pullman schools too.
So then you have Hawkins at a 40% build-out. Now, how long will it take them to get to a 40% build-out?
It's hard to say. I mean, you know, it just depends on, you know, what the market is like. And you know, I think they've got the agreement with Lowe's. I've heard that they recently reached an agreement with another large retailer, but of course...
Hopefully,
you know,
not Walmart.
That's not public as to who that is.
Okay.
You know, I would tend to think it's not going to be Walmart for a variety of reasons. You know, one is that the site is not really, you know, Walmart doesn't really build non-super centers anymore, and the largest sites at Hawkins are 160,000 square feet, and which is kind of well below, I mean, that could be a super center, but it'd be a very small one, and so I'm not saying it's outside the realm of possibility. That rumor's been going around for years and years, but I tend to think the answer is no to that one, but it could happen.
Yeah. And as I was sort of pointing out earlier, that would actually be hurtful. I mean, if they were to say, let's not build in Pullman, let's build out there, I think that would be hurtful in two ways. First, I mean, obviously you take out a huge tax base from the city of Pullman and put it out there in the county, which
right.
I've always pointed out, even if it's in Whitman County, it's going to help Whitman County. It's going to help Pullman because Pullman is in Whitman County. However,
and it helps our schools. I mean, the Hawkins development gives us a lot. I mean, it's not a direct benefit like a Walmart, but it's not like we'll get nothing out of it. Because,
right.
Like I said, the schools, of course, are a major benefiter from it. But there's a lot of other things, too, like Rural 5 District 12, which, okay, you know, for people who live in quote-unquote rural Pullman get a lot of benefit from having, you know, Fire District 12. That's their fire and ambulance service. Not to mention Fire District 12 is often called to help out with Pullman fires as well, like last November 15th when we had the rash of arsons.
Sure.
Or the grain elevator fire. You know, it was Fire District 12, I think, that took the main responsibility on the grain elevator fire last summer.
Yeah, that's one of those ones where it's like you're not quite sure if that's technically city or county when you get out there. You know, it's one of those.
Yeah, I just know that there weren't. I mean, I just remember the problems. You know, were that, you know, there weren't any fire hydrants. I mean, it might be considered the city, but there certainly weren't any fire hydrants close by. I mean, there was a famous picture in the newspaper showing like how far they had to run the hose from the closest fire hydrant to get out there.
Yeah. It was a long, long, long way, which is definitely reason why fire hydrants are good.
Yeah, yeah.
But
you couldn't just have pumper trucks. I mean, that was the blaze was so big, they had to have a lot more water than, and it smoldered for weeks afterwards. The pumper trucks couldn't just have enough water to do it. So.
Oh, yeah. The grain fires, I've seen a couple different ones in different places around the county, and they tend to do that kind of thing where, you know, if there's grain in there, they'll just sit there and they'll smolder for weeks on end. They'll be really hot and everything.
Sure.
So.
Well, that one definitely did. So. And then, of course, you know, another benefit, too, to Pullman is, you know, I would say, you know, people talk about high-tech jobs. Well, all of the high-tech jobs in Pullman are in the Port of Whitman Industrial Park. And, of course, the Port of Whitman Port of Whitman County also would get a considerable amount of money from the Hawkins development as well. And so, of course, that would go, not all of it, but a good deal of it would go towards improvements in the Port Industrial Park here in Pullman, you know, to bring in more high-tech businesses.
So with the Port of Whitman, the park up there, you work up in that area.
Yep.
And you've seen the explosive growth in the last 7 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
Are they getting close to running out of room up there?
Well, you know, they have this new incubator zone that got approved by the state last year, like a high-tech incubator zone. And the one that Whitman County proposed, our proposal, is kind of a green energy, you know, renewable energy type incubator zone. And actually, they if there's any, like, businesses that are created or spun off of that, they have actually purchased land to the north of the industrial park to use for additional space. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say we run out of land up here, but, you know, obviously the vast majority of land at the industrial park is not even part of the port anymore. It's actually owned by Schweitzer Engineering, and we purchased the land from the county. But I think there are a few slots open. There's at least probably two or three I can think of that are open. So there's still some room for growth. But like I said, they have purchased area for kind of a satellite business park that would be associated with this innovation zone.
And it would be north of where the current one is,
mm-hmm.
where
up near the road that goes to Albion.
Oh, okay, yeah. So there you got the incubator for possibly green businesses, green energy businesses?
Right, that was what the proposal was for, yeah.
Interesting. So the website, Palousatix.com, and there is one article on there I was wanting to start reading, but I haven't actually had a chance yet, and maybe you could sort of fill me on what it is.
Sure.
It was about it deals with the Centralia Chronicle, and it sounds like the Democrats have taken some of their information out of context.
Mm-hmm.
The Centralia Chronicle's out of context, and it's not making the Centralia context very very happy, the Chronicle.
No, it's another you know, as I've stated before, you know, Dino Rossi must really scare the Democrats in Washington, is all I can say, because here it is, it's, you know, the original attack had started in February, but here it is just March, you know, the election is still, you know, 8 months away, and they're already, you know, using all of the nastiest types of attack ads they can to go after Dino Rossi, and I have a feeling a lot of this is going to, you know, to backfire, and this latest incident is, you know, Rossi, and I think with a lot of justification, was critical of Governor Gregoire's response to, you remember the big flooding that happened in particularly, well, all of Western Washington, but particularly Lewis County in December of last year.
Right.
And by Lewis County, I mean the Centralia-Chehalis area there along I-5. If you remember, like, I-5 was closed for a week because it was submerged underwater, and virtually all of Centralia was underwater. I mean, if you remember seeing the aerial photos, that whole, you know, as you're going down I-5, you go through Centralia, there's kind of like the big outlet mall there, and there's like a big Walmart and a big Home Depot, and all that whole area was completely, you know, flooded by the Chehalis River, and so Rossi has, you know, kind of been pointing out, and like I said, that's what you do when you're running against someone, is you say that I can do a better job than that other person, and so now they've taken some comments that he made with regards to that, the Democrats have, and turned it into this this attack ad where they're accusing him of being sleazy for exploiting tragedy. and what they've done is they've taken all these images from, and I would point out that those are images that they probably are using without permission from local news media, including the newspaper, They took the newspaper of the Centralia Chronicle and put something that looked like it was on the front page of the Chronicle that never actually was on the front page of the Chronicle to make it, you know, they altered it to make it look worse for Rossi. And then they put all this menacing music in the background and everything, and it's ridiculous. You know, and the paper really, you know, not only takes exception to the fact that they, you know, that they have manipulated their paper this way, but also the, you know, fact that they're already resorting to, you know, calling Rossi sleazy. I mean, he's not. I mean, he's a politician. He's pointing out differences. He's not being sleazy by exploiting tragedy. And as I remind readers on the blog that if, you know, anyone wants to talk about exploiting tragedy, let us not forget 3 years ago when I-912 was before the voters, and that was the initiative to eliminate the 9.5-cent gas tax, and that brought out every, you talk about exploiting tragedy, that brought out, first of all of the ads saying, my God, what's going to happen when the earthquake brings the viaduct down? There's going to be all these people in Seattle that are crushed in their cars just like they were, you know, in Oakland back when there was the earthquake in 1989. And then Hurricane Katrina came along, and that became another tragedy for them to exploit and to say, oh, my God, if there's ever a big tsunami or some other big flood that hits Seattle, my God, people won't be able to get out of the town. They'll be trapped just like they were trapped in New Orleans, you know. And there was even one further tragedy that they exploited that happened, like, right the weekend before the vote. There was a landslide at Snoqualmie Pass, and I think a couple of people were killed. You know, that was like, I think, that was like Dad's weekend, too, and a lot of people were stuck going home from Pullman that day because the pass was closed, of course, for hours and hours and hours because of the landslide. And again, that factored into, you know, the ad. So it's like, who's talking to who about exploiting tragedy for political purposes? It's silly. It's ridiculous.
Exactly. And it's interesting, too. I've pointed this out before. They talk about how the viaduct and the 520 bridge are in dire need of being replaced. They, you know, they're an inch away from falling down and crumbling and stuff. And I'm like,
right,
if they were
thousands of people, in
yeah.
The process.
And if they are really that close and that dangerous, the city should shut them down now, even without a replacement, because they're so dangerous. But I argue that they obviously can't be that dangerous right now because they're not shut down.
Well, not only are they not shut down, you know, the money that supposedly we all, you know, had this dire need, we had to fork over the money right away. We had to, because they had to rebuild the viaduct. They just had to start on it right away. So what ends up happening is, you know, Gregoire vacillates back and forth. We're going to rebuild it. No, we're not. We're going to rebuild it. No, we're not. We're going to. All right, I'll just let the people of Seattle decide. So the people of Seattle had a vote on it last year, and no one could decide what they wanted to do with it. You know, there's the faction that wants to rebuild. There's another faction that wants to improve their property values and put in a tunnel along the waterfront in Seattle, which would be 10 times more expensive than the viaduct. And then there's another faction of the eco nuts who don't want anyone to drive it, says, well, let's just tear the damn thing down and not even rebuild it with anything. Let people take public transportation to work.
Yes.
So now nothing is happening. So after this dire emergency that everyone talked about 3 years ago, nothing has happened. There's no plan whatsoever to deal with the viaduct or the 520 bridge, for that matter.
And it's really interesting, too, the 520 bridge. It's like, well, let's see here. We have a two-lane in each direction bridge that is so horribly packed full of cars during the peak commute hours that it's almost impossible to want to navigate across that bridge, and there's still talk of possibly replacing it with the exact same size bridge. And I'm like, what? Why? We already see a need for a larger bridge.
Yeah, it's I think if anything, you know, the people of this state need to realize that the Democratic Party of Washington is so in bed with the green movement and the environmentalists in the state, that there, as long as the Democrats are in charge in Olympia, there will be no serious transportation solutions anywhere in the state. Because all the Greens want to do is deliberately make traffic as worse as possible to encourage people not to drive, or even better, not to move to Washington, because that would be the ultimate goal, is to have gridlock on every road and have all those crazy Californians move back down south. And then Seattle would be like it was 50 years ago.
Yeah.
So,
great.
Of course, those are totally unrealistic situations. You know, those are the attitudes they have about the urban growth boundary. Like, well, if we set these urban growth boundaries in Seattle that, you know, poor people can't go out, then that'll just discourage population growth. Well, that's nuts. The population growth in Seattle has continued unabated because there's lots of good jobs to be had there at Boeing and Microsoft and everything else and all the industry they spawn up. So people keep pouring into Seattle. And all that's happened is the price of housing has, like, tripled in the last 15 years, and most of that because of the urban growth boundary.
And I was reading on Politics, you had done a you recently did a talk over at the University of Idaho, and you posted your PowerPoint presentation that you used online, and I downloaded that and read through it. And there was a lot of information in there that was really interesting that you said it sounds like the students were very receptive and open and thoughtful,
yes,
in their listening.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's like they never heard stuff like this before, and you know, probably since they're in university, they never have heard any of this stuff before. You know, they never talk about, you know, all you ever hear about is like how wonderful smart growth is. We've got to have smart growth. We've got to. We can't have sprawl. Sprawl is so horrible. We just got to stop it. But never, no one ever talks about there is a cost that's associated with that. And the people in Seattle now have found out all too well what that cost is. You know, it's this University of Washington study that I referred to has determined that the land use regulations that have been adopted primarily by the state of Washington through the Growth Management Act have added $200,000 onto the price of an average home in Seattle. That's about 40% of the cost of a house is land use regulations. That's insanity. There is a cost to all this stuff, and it hasn't stopped the sprawl. I mean, you know, it doesn't stop it. You know, it's crazy to think you're going to stop forces of nature. You know, these are population growth. People want to, you know, they want amenities, they want services. You know, growth is a natural part of human nature and nature in itself. And to think that you can somehow pass legislation or have fancy buzzwords to stop it is ridiculous. You know, you can. The best thing to do is to accept that it's going to happen and plan for it accordingly, rather than try to draw a line and say, you know, we're not going to allow it to happen because it will happen anyway, and then you end up with all these huge costs like they have now in Seattle and King County.
And what's really funny is that it's these people who want no sprawl. They want all the growth to be compact. They want living and shopping and working options all within a real close radius, so realistically you could walk everywhere and never need to own a car, and if you did need to go somewhere a little farther, you could take a bus and still never need to own a car, and you have all this stuff. But then when a older landmark, so to speak, for the area decides to sell and a new business wants to come in, what happens? Immediately, oh, you can't tear that down and build this compact housing unit. And then they, when it does happen, they're like, oh, not another condo building. That's
right.
All we need. And it's like, that's exactly what you want. Now you're getting what you want, but you don't want it.
I know. Well, because in like the article, the report, the UW report pointed out so well is, it's the people that want these things are the people that already have houses. You know, these are the people that are older,
exactly,
they're more well off, they've already got their house. They drive to work anyway, they just don't want anyone else to drive to work.
Right.
They have a big house, but they don't want anyone else to have a big house.
They don't want any neighbors. They want to have their space. They want to live out in the country. They
right.
want to have a
they
quick drive.
They don't
want
anyone else to have their space.
Exactly.
That's the drawbridge mentality. We're here now. Oh, I like it that houses are worth $500,000 because it makes my house worth a whole lot. You know, if you have a house in the Seattle area, you probably don't want them to build any more houses because it makes the equity in your house incredible.
Exactly. I know for most of the people that I work with over in the Seattle area, none of them can afford to actually buy and own a house in Seattle or even in the Bellevue area for that matter. For
oh, sure. I would say anywhere within, like, you know, metropolitan King County. I mean, outside, towards Duval maybe or something like that, but certainly not within the urban area of King County anywhere.
No, not at all. So it's sort of interesting. I've actually looked at housing prices over there, and, you know, a house that my parents bought for around $17,000, they just recently sold for over $300,000.
Sure.
And it's like,
people that are in situations like that are not necessarily inclined to support legislation that would lower the value of their houses.
Well, no, nobody wants to lower the value of their house.
They like having it worth $300,000.
Yeah.
Versus maybe having it worth $200,000.
Exactly. You always want, I mean, when it's yours, you want it to be valuable. You want to be able to pull in as much money as you can. That's just the way things are. That's human nature. It's like,
sure.
Who's going to want to go, you know, I really am hoping my house goes down in value or doesn't increase at all in value. So that way I could sell it to the next guy for the exact same price I paid for it because I'm such a good person.
No, no one wants that. But I mean, let's be clear about what the motivations are. You know, all of this talk about smart growth and stopping sprawl, a lot of it is just fluffery to conceal, you know, that kind of selfishness that you're talking about. I mean, it's perfectly understandable human attitude, but let's not call it anything more than what it is.
Exactly.
It's selfishness.
Exactly.
You're looking out for yourself. But then when you attach the term smart growth to it, then somehow it becomes this environmentally friendly, noble thing that you're believing in versus just your own, you know, best interest.
And I haven't actually heard much about this for about 2 weeks now. But I believe it was last Saturday, not last, but two Saturdays ago, just before I came on the air Monday of 2 weeks ago, there was those arsons over in the Seattle area.
Right.
And the there was a lot of question whether ALF was responsible for those, whether ALF was responsible for those arsons. And the quotation, green, I think not, or something like that.
Right.
I'm just sort of curious if that kind of, if that has, if anything more has come out about that, if you've heard any. I haven't heard anything, but I know the website of one of the newspapers over there, they allow online commenting, and it was really amazing how many commenters were actually thinking that, no, it wasn't really ALF. Actually, it would be ELF, the Earth Liberation Front.
Right.
It wasn't them that was involved in it. It was actually most likely the developers who built the area that actually burnt down their own houses in order to collect the tax money because they weren't being sold. And it was really amazing. And some people were even apologetic towards the ELF group. I mean, it's amazing the kind of mentality that some of the people over there have.
Well, you know, certainly it's always possible that that could have been an arson that the developers set. I mean, you can never rule anything out in a situation like that, but it certainly fits the motif of the ELF. They set other fires like that in other areas of the country in housing development. So, you know, they've gone after SUVs. Until I hear something different, I'm going to believe that that's who it was. But again, it's not beyond the realm of possibility that it was an inside job for money or whatever. So.
Right. Well, I appreciate the call again, Tom. As
yep.
always, it's fun to chat. You have a great day at work, huh?
You too. I'll talk to you later, Scott.
Have a good
one. All right, bye.
Once again, that was Tom Forbes from Palousatix.com, and you are listening to the PES on KZUU. You're listening to the PES on KZUU 90.7 FM, broadcasting live from the dark, damp dungeons of Smith Gym. Reach us on the telephone at 335-2207, on the web at www.kzuu.org, and on our show's website, www.thepes.com. KZUU is made possible in part by Heroes in Sports, located at 245 Northeast Kamaiken Street. Pullman's Hometown Deli offers a variety of sandwiches, salads, and soups, with catering available. More information can be found by calling Heroes in Sports at 509-334-5423. Had a bad weekend? Need legal counseling? Student Legal Services at WSU is happy to help. Student Legal Services is a student-run organization that provides free legal advice to students. So if you need their help, stop by their office in Annex Room 305. They're open Monday through Thursday, 9 to 5, and Friday, 9 to 1. Chemistry is everywhere. It's in the water we use, the shoes we wear, and in the food that we eat. If you're interested in chemistry, come join the Chemistry Club every second and third Tuesday in Fulmer Room 315 at 5:30 p.m. and partake in the various chemistry demonstrations throughout the year. For more information, contact Sean Richardson, 509-845-5196. The Whitman County Humane Society is in need of volunteers. Located in Pullman, the shelter is dedicated to caring for stray, abandoned, and abused animals. Opportunities include walking, feeding, and grooming the animals. For more information, call shelter at 332-3422 or visit them at the web at www.whitmanpets.org. The dogs and the cats will thank you with their unconditional love. What do we got coming up in hour two? Well, stay tuned and I'll tell you. But it will include gas-guzzling SUVs owned by knees. And in the meantime, the favorites of the PES, the Reverend, Reverend Horton Heat. The favorite of the PES, the Reverend, Reverend Horton Heat. And welcome back. Here we are, hour number two of the day after spring break. Tom's not in today because he is an overachiever who's celebrating an extra week of spring break. I don't know why, I don't know where, don't know how, but I'm sure he's celebrating hardcore because that's the kind of guy he is. Wild and wacky, right? Actually, it's sort of nice without him here. I can have all the lights off and be totally, totally all about saving electricity, because that's why I have the lights off, not because I like it dark, but because I'm saving electricity. Plus, being in the dark, damp dungeons of Smith Gym, I guess it's more appropriate to have the lights turned off to make it dark and more dungeon-esque. And it is so hot in here, it's sort of like, I almost wonder if I go out the back door, if I'll see the flames of hell, the flakes of fire and brimstone and so on. Anyway, so here we got SUVs, and we have the Tom and I talked about, Tom Westfall and I talked about the possible coming of a green residence hall, a brand new residence hall that's being built on campus. Really, the first new building that's going to be a residence hall for as long as I can remember. White Hall was turned into Honors Hall several years back, but it was already there. They just totally renovated it and made it into a residence hall. There's been talk, Krugel McAllister supposedly is going to be coming down. It's been condemned for throughout the 90s and now. I mean, it's never really been used as a long-term residence hall. They've housed students in there from time to time for various reasons and needs, but it's never really been a residence hall. Ganna Goldsworthy, I think, is one that also could probably use a cleanup by coming down and maybe something else being built in its place. Or maybe just more green space, you know, because that's the way things are going these days. Let's tear down buildings and put up grass, because grass is so much more pretty and more pristine, and it's so pretty and it makes me feel good. But anyway, the Ad Annex right across from the main entrance to Todd, right out by Eastlick there, is going to be coming down to make way for grass. It's sort of like some years back they tore down the anthropology labs in order to make parking. So, I guess you got to take down what's not being used and put up what would be used. And, you know, college students love their grass. So, here I am owning a truck, a large truck, a Dodge truck, a manly truck, a truck with a Hemi. And I got rid of it. So, I had it for 5 months. It needed an oil change, and I was like, oh, time to get a new one. Actually, it didn't really work like that, but it did turn out that I did need an oil change right at the same time I traded it in, so it's sort of for a fun story that that's why I traded it in. When people are like, why did you get a new vehicle? I'm like, well, the other one needed an oil change. And they're like, what? I'm like, yeah, I know. It was dumb. But anyway, so I went to... I guess I'll rewind back and go back quite a ways. My first vehicle was a 1980 Toyota pickup truck. And everybody's like, oh, yeah, that's cool. They get good gas mileage. I was like, 13 miles a gallon ain't that good. They're like, come on, it's a Toyota. You get better. I'm like, no, trust me. I've calculated it out many, many, many times. And I'll still calculate it out today. You know, it's the whole fill it up, drive a while, fill it up again, figure out how many gallons you put in, how many miles driven since you've last filled it up, divide them out, boom, you got miles per gallon. And I get, honestly, around 13 miles a gallon with the Toyota. And there could be various reasons. One is oversized tires, making it harder for the engine to work, and, you know, various other things. So I don't get great gas mileage in it. And then from there, I had, for a little while, I had a Saab, a 900S four-door car that got relatively decent gas mileage. And that's what I was looking for, is something like that. But I had it here the winter of 95 or so, and that was the year, it was sort of like this winter where it was just tons and tons of snow, and I was getting stuck all the time, having to get pulled out. Even though the Saab had front-wheel drive, it just didn't work very well compared to my four-wheel drive. As a matter of fact, one day I had to chain up to get out of a parking spot. The parking spot was a little icy. The roads themselves and the driveways and the whatnot were not icy. It was just the parking area. And I actually had to put on chains to drive 3 feet in order to continue going. And that was when I said, this is just a bunch of crud. I need a four-wheel drive truck again. And I still had my Toyota, but it was over in the Seattle area, so that didn't do me much good. So then I get rid of the Saab, and I'm looking for, well, actually, I sort of just stopped using the Saab, and I was looking for a four-wheel drive daily driving vehicle. And I wanted a four-door truck, because when I grew up, my dad had a four-door truck, and, you know, I thought that was really cool, a four-door truck, how neat. And that's what I wanted, and when I was wanting this four-door truck, they were hard to find, they were hard to come by. Dodge was only making a four-door truck in the Dakota, the smaller size vehicle. They weren't even making it in the larger ones back in 01. But that's what I wanted, so I got led towards a Dakota. I also looked at the Ford F-150, but I wasn't a big fan of the look of the body style. It just seemed too tinfoilish versus beefy. I was looking for something that looked like it could take a hit against a fly and not dent. So, stayed away from the Ford, went with Dodge, spec'd out a truck. I got the I got a 215-inch cubic inch engine with a 5-speed manual because I wanted a 6-shift. It's a 4-door truck, a sort of a royal blue color. Everything about that truck, I loved it. And I had it for a couple years, and then I decided, you know, I want to get a camper. And I already owned by this time a boat. I wanted a camper, and I wanted a full-size truck so I could put a camper on it. Well, the problem was is that I didn't know a lot about campers as far as weights and what vehicle I should get and everything, and I was sort of ill-advised. I got myself a 1500, which is a half-ton truck. For those who don't know, that's not very good for carrying a camper that's going to have any water on board. You could pretty much carry a non-self-contained camper, which essentially means there's no water holding tanks, there's no gray water tanks, no sewer tanks or anything, which essentially means you have a bed and maybe some food preparation area such as a stove and an oven, but there's no real running water, there's no toilets or anything. And I'm like, well, that's not really going to be much good. I mean, it's a glorified tent, a heavy tent. So I decided that, so I got the truck, and as it turned out, I started looking for campers, could never find anything that I wanted. And I realized, realistically, what I'm going to have to do is get a bigger truck. So in October, I went looking around at vehicles, and sure enough, I find a 2500, which is a 3/4-ton truck, which is going to be a little bit better for carrying a camper. My plan was camper on the truck. I got an 8-foot box so I could not be limited in camper size. Then I'd be able to still tow my boat, so I'd have a camper and a boat so I could go down to the river, launch the boat, use the camper, make a weekend out of it, have a great time. Going to softball tournaments, I have my camper, life is good. And that's what the plan was. So I get the truck in October, and that was a very interesting experience buying the vehicle, because I had to play the game. And, you know, the game is, it gets tiresome, because I've played it a couple times now recently, and I get sort of bored of the game. And when I say the game, if you've never played the game, you should go out and play it once. But you should only play it if you have a very experienced person at playing the game with you. If you go in there having never played the game, you will get beaten, and it won't feel good in the end, because there is no amount of lubrication that will save you from the salesman. So anyway, there you are, and you're playing the game. And the game is this. They price the car, but it's not the price you're going to pay. That's the price, well, if you're just a total silly guy that doesn't know anything, you'll pay it. But nobody pays the price on the sticker immediately. You got to play the game. And the game is this. And let me give you some pointers here. First off, you're trading. Typically, they're going to, it's a business, so they're there to make money. And I'm not going to begrudge them some sort of profit, because that's what they're there for. And I understand that. They're offering me a service by getting these vehicles to me. They're offering me some expertise by having somebody who's knowledgeable in different vehicles to give me pros and cons of different things. They're offering this kind of stuff, and I need to pay for it. I don't have a problem with that. But the question is, what's a fair price to pay? And the problem is that most of these salesmen are paid on a commission of some sort, which means the more they sell the car for, the better off it is on them. So they're not necessarily your advocate. They're not out there to try to get you the best price on the car. They're out there to get them the best price on the car, which means essentially they're your friend, and they'll show you every car and they'll tell you all you want to know. But when it comes to buying it, that's when they become your negotiating partner, and they're not your partner to help you. They're trying to get as much out of you as possible, but they're your friend, of course. They're going to do their best, and what happens is that it's the general manager who becomes the bad guy, and not the car salesman, because the car salesman's in it for you. But that's part of the game. What will typically happen is they'll set you down and they'll say, okay, well, what do you have for a trade-in? And then they'll look at your trade-in and they tell you, well, this is what we could probably give you for your trade-in. Well, the thing is that you can go to KellyBlueBook.com, KBB.com, and put in all this information and get an idea of what your car may or may not be worth at a trade-in level versus a retail sale level. And a retail sale level is essentially, if they're going to sell that car to you off of their lot, this is how much they would pay. If they're going to take it on a trade-in, this is how much they're going to offer you. If you're going to sell it private party, meaning you put an ad in the paper and somebody else buys it from you, this is what you get. Now, you'll always get more if you sell it private party than if you sell it via a car lot, because they need to make a profit. And they're not going to make a profit if they give you exactly what the vehicle's worth, because they're not going to be able to sell it for that. They'd have to sell it for more than that. And nobody's going to buy it for more than it's worth, or very few people are. So they have to have some room to play, some room to be able to put a couple dollars into the car for detailing and whatnot, and then still be able to sell it at a profit. And that's their whole goal, is to sell vehicles at a profit. So you have your trade-in, and the problem is, and this is really important, cars today are so expensive in terms of your money income. You know, a three-year car loan used to be pretty much a long, I mean, that was 36 months is all you normally had to use for paying off a car. Well, nowadays, people are getting seven-year car loans. Most of the time, the car, this is where you get upside down. Most of the time, the car, when you drive it off the lot, you all of a sudden owe more on the car than the car is worth. Because at one time, you would actually pay a fair amount of money down. And that money down brought the money that you paid for the car lower. So when you drive it off the lot, there wasn't that hit against your payments of what you owe. So if you buy a $40,000 vehicle and you put no money down, you drive it off the lot, now all of a sudden you got a used car that's worth $35,000, but you've now gotten a loan for $40,000, there's essentially $5,000 of value that you've lost in that car, but you owe. Therefore, you're upside down. Because if you had to sell that car today, and you were only able to get $35,000, you would owe out of pocket $5,000. That makes you upside down. They now sell something called gap insurance. And the whole idea of gap insurance is that, okay, you owe more than your car is worth. You get in a car accident. The insurance company comes and says, yes, we are going to pay you X amount of money for that car. We're not going to pay you what you owe in the loan. We're going to pay you what that car is worth. Well, I owe more than that. Oh, too bad, too sad. You got to pay it out of pocket. And that's where gap insurance comes in these days. It's a new insurance that you buy that says, if you get a $40,000 loan and your car is worth $35,000 and you wreck it, your gap insurance will pay that extra $5,000 so it doesn't cost you anything out of pocket. And just think about that. They have this product now because of the need. And the need is there because cars are so expensive in terms of what people have and what they're putting down on the car. If you were to have put, say, $7,000 down on that car, so you bought a $40,000 car, you paid $7,000, so really you're getting a loan for $33,000. You drive it off the lot, and now it's worth now the car's worth $35,000, your loan is worth $33,000, you're not upside down. If the car gets damaged in a car accident beyond repair, the insurance company gives you $35,000, you pay $32,000 to the loan, or you pay $33,000 to the loan, and boom, you still have $2,000 in hand because of what you weren't upside down in the car. So the problem is people get themselves into new cars and they get upside down in it. And what will happen is, and this is really bad, this really gets you upside down in cars. So you go to the car salesman and says, yes, I want to trade in this car. They take a look at it and say, okay, how much do you own it? You're like, well, okay, so new car scenario. I have a vehicle, and let's say I owe $20,000 on the vehicle now. And they decide that trade-in value, it's worth $17,000. So there's a gap, there's a difference of $3,000. So essentially, I owe more than the car is worth. Well, one of the neat little things they'll do for you is they'll still let you do the trade-in, and then they'll take that $3,000, and they will add that into the price. They will take that $3,000 and add it into the amount of money in your new loan. So essentially, you roll the amount of money in your old loan into your new loan. And oh yeah, that's great, because now you get a new car. But here's the problem there. You've just now put yourself $3,000 more upside down in your new car. So let's use that $40,000 car again. You buy a $40,000 car. You roll $3,000 of the old loan into the new loan, so now essentially you've gotten a loan for $43,000 on a $40,000 car. So right out the door, you're already $3,000 upside down. And then you drive it off the lot, the car loses, say, $5,000 in value. The car is worth $35,000, you owe $43,000. You're $8,000 upside down. That is a problem. And this is what people are getting themselves into because they allow themselves to get into this. The car salesman is there to make money. The dealership is there to make money. And they're going to do everything in their power to help you get into that car. And they're going to play the game. Well, let me tell you a little bit about the game. So now that you understand some of the problems with financing cars, and I'll tell you what, they will find financing for you. They will do what they can to get you into any kind of financing. My suggestion is that you find your own financing, because more times than not, you're going to do better with your own financing. And some car dealerships actually are able to add a couple percentage points onto the financing they find for you. For instance, they go through their preferred lender. Their preferred lender says, oh yeah, I will give this person a loan at, say, 6.25%. Well, then the car dealership could come back to you going, hey, buddy, I found you a loan. It's wonderful. It's only 8%. And little did you know, it really was a 6.25, but they've added some percentage points on there, and that's going to be money they get. So get your own car loan. And there's a lot of different places you can do it. As a resident of the state of Washington, you're able to join the Boeing Employee Credit Union. That's just anybody in the state of Washington can outright join the Boeing Employee Credit Union. I don't know about WSU students, but if you're staff or faculty at WSU or any other government agency, you can join the Washington State Employee Credit Union. And both of them, most credit unions offer loans of any variety, of homes and personal loans and car loans. And you can go to either BECU, Boeing Employee Credit Union, or Washington State Public Credit Union, or any other credit union for that matter, or your local bank. It doesn't really matter. But credit unions tend to have a little less interest rate on their loans to their members. So you go to, say, BECU, which is what I did, and I said, hey, I want to get a car loan. What can I qualify for? So they qualified me for the car loan. It was ready to go. All I had to do was tell them what car I bought, and then the loan was done. I didn't have to worry about the dealership trying to get me a loan. I didn't have to do any of that kind of stuff. And it made one step of the process that much easier. I didn't have to play the game times two. I only had to play the game. So there I am in the car dealership. And the first step along the way is looking at the cars, finding the one you want. Now, a lot of people will, well, let me just tell you, the last, up until the one that I just purchased the other day, before that, I had purchased one in October. And I was really hemming and hawing over buying it because it had almost everything I wanted. It just had one thing it did not have was the steering wheel audio controls. And for people who have had steering wheel audio controls, to not have them anymore is actually a big deal. I didn't know how big of a deal it was until I got into a vehicle that didn't have them after I had had them. And then I was like, you know what? I'm really upset about the fact that I don't have them anymore. But that was almost a breaking point on this vehicle, because it was like perfect in every other way. It had many less miles. It was the exact same color, 8-foot box instead of the 6-foot box. It had a spray in liner. It had a rear split window, which is something I wanted. Inside it had a whole bunch of the other features that I wanted in a vehicle. It was the truck I wanted, except for the steering wheel audio controls. If the steering wheel audio controls were there, it would have been the vehicle I wanted, no question about it. So anyway, that was sort of a make or break thing. But this car dealer guy that I was dealing with, he's trying to tell me, he goes, well, you can't find everything you want in a car. There's never a perfect car. And I looked at him. I said, yes, there's a perfect car. As a matter of fact, the last truck I owned was the perfect car, was a perfect vehicle. It had everything I wanted. So don't tell me I can't find everything I want. And if you get somebody who's going to tell you that, you can just walk out on them, because that's not the kind of guy you want to deal with. You want to find the can-do guy. You want to find the guy who's, obviously the car dealer that I was dealing with, what he cared about was selling me a car on the lot right now. He didn't care about getting me into the car that I wanted. And that's what you need to find. You need to find somebody who can tell you, you know what, that's not the car for you. You need to find somebody who is willing to say that to you. And if you can't find that person, if you're not dealing with that person, then you need to find somebody else, because the dealer I was dealing with was not that guy. He was trying to get me into anything that was on the lot. And that's not the kind of person you want to be with. You want to be with the kind of guy that's going to be like, that car's just not your style. It's not the right size for you. It's not going to be good for you in the future because of this reason. It's too small for what you want, or it's too much car for what you want. There's a lot of things that they could tell you, and they could be there to help you get the right car. And that way you're happy with the car when you leave the lot. So You do the test drive, you find the car that you like, you check everything out. And one thing I'm saying right now is don't settle. Make a list of things that are must-haves. And if the car has everything but one of them, don't get it. Because the one mistake that people tend to make is, oh, this is the car, this is the perfect one, this has everything, and the price is incredible. Think about that. There are millions of cars out there. Your car is out there somewhere. And the price you want to pay for it is out there somewhere. Sometimes it just is a matter of looking for it. But do not settle on a car, because you will be disappointed. You will be upset about it. And when you're going to be paying off a loan for 3, 5, or 7 years, you don't want to be thinking about the fact that you settled on something. Because every month for 7 years, 70, 80 months, 80 times, you're going to go, dang it, I settled on this car and I'm paying it off. And every single time I make a payment, I'm making a payment on something I settled on. You don't want to do that to yourself. You don't want to settle. So you keep looking until you find the right car. And that search for me took me to all the dealerships in Pullman, took me to the dealerships in Moscow. And upon failing to find what I wanted at both cities, I then had to move my search further away. And I made a trip up to Spokane, and I went to the Dodge dealership up there because they had a couple Durangos that I wanted to look at. And here was the thing. I wasn't sure what I wanted. I was actually open-minded about it going into it. I said, sell me on the car that's going to be for me. And I said that to myself, not to the dealer, of course. But I wanted to give all cars an option, a fair chance of being selected. I was willing to look at Ford Explorers, F-150s, 1500s. Dodge Dakotas, Dodge Durangos. They even have the new Nitros out. I was willing to look at a lot of different vehicles, but there were definitely some I won't look at. I wasn't going to look at an Escape. It's too small. I didn't want that small of a vehicle. Even the Dakota might have been a little bit small, I wasn't sure. And I was going back and forth, and I wanted it. That's why I was looking around a lot of stuff. And I was looking at getting a vehicle that was going to serve my purposes. My original purposes when I got the truck, the larger truck, was a camper. I want a camper and be able to tow the boat. Well, I sold my boat. Now I don't need to tow anything. Well, I'm buying a camper from my, or excuse me, not a camper, I'm buying a motorhome from my parents. Well, I don't need a camper anymore either. So why do I need the humongous truck? I have this humongous truck that could hold a camper and a boat, and I don't have either of them, and I'm not going to be getting either of them. no reason to have that humongous truck anymore. I can't even fit it in my garage. I want something I could have in my garage. So there we go. There's one aspect. Whatever it is needs to fit in my garage. Okay. So now that gives me a starting point. What are some other things? Well, I wrote down the other things that the vehicle had to have. And one of them was steering wheel audio controls. And it really made the search easy. Because as I was searching the web for all the different vehicles that were out there, the first photo I looked at was the one they had of the vehicle, of the steering wheel. And if I didn't see steering wheel audio controls, I just went to the next vehicle. I didn't even look at any other features. That, to me, was the make or break. That was a make or break. So there I am, checking out every vehicle. If it doesn't have steering wheel audio controls, don't even show it to me because I don't want it. I won't buy it. So that was one. And then if it was a truck, it was going to have a split rear window. It was going to have to be a true four-door truck. I wanted, a few other things. And I was also looking at the possibility of something like an Explorer or an Explorer or a Durango, mainly because both of those would fit in my garage. Both of them are four-door vehicles. You could fit five people in them pretty comfortably. Plus, the part for me that's really handy is the back portion of it. And the Durango actually has a third row of seats, but you can fold them down, and I can store my stuff. Because currently, I have to store everything in the back seat of the truck, which meant if anybody needed a ride with me, I either needed to pull everything out ahead of time anticipating this, or I'd have to put it in the very back, unsecured, uncovered part of the truck. So with the Durango, I can keep this stuff in the very back. It's always out of the way. I won't be taking up seating space. Five people can fit in there. So, and if I needed to fit a couple more people in there one day, I could then pull those items out, fold the third row of seats back to their normal position, and haul even more people. So there was that aspect of it that I really liked about the idea of an Explorer, a Durango. And I looked around and I found a vehicle. I went out and took it for a test drive. Then I went with a little bit of an older, higher mileage vehicle. And I took that one for a test drive. Both of them were Durangos. One was an 03 and one was an 07 Durango. And what I found was the 03 Durango was actually smaller than the 07 Durango. The 07 is a larger overall sized vehicle. And I noticed when I was sitting in it, it was definitely a little bit more compact than the 03. So after driving both and taking the pros and the cons, one of the pros of the older, higher mileage vehicle is the fact that the amount of money that I was going to pay would be lower. And when it was all said and done, the amount of money that I owed in the end would be lower. If I got the newer vehicle, well, it's less miles. And in, say, 5 years from now, my 03 would be a 10-year-old vehicle. And 5 years from now, my 07 is going to be a 5-year-old vehicle. So there is that aspect of it, too. So I looked at a lot of stuff like that, and I decided that the newer 07 was probably going to be the better option for me. Overall, I liked it a little bit better. So now it's time to play the game. And the first, I knew the game was on as soon as, when I talked to this dealer on the telephone, I told him what my trade-in was. I said, yeah, I got a 2500 Dodge Ram with a Hemi, four-door quad cab, bedliner, blah, blah. I mean, pretty much loaded. And he's like, oh, wow, that's great. We only have like one of those on the lot right now, and we really need more of those. So, I mean, we're going to be able to get you top dollar. He's just telling me all these great things. I get up there, and he's like, oh, yeah. I don't know if we're going to be able to get much for you. I mean, it was like a different story. It was 180 degrees different than what he told me on the phone before I left Pullman to go to Spokane. So I was a little bit perturbed over that. And it's interesting because, that might be enough for some people to just say, okay, screw you. You told me one thing on the telephone. I get up here after driving for an hour and a half, and you're telling me something totally different now. You're not being honest with me, and I'm not going to deal with you. Bye. But, I'm one of those people that I believe there could be a logical reason for this to have happened, and that to me wasn't really a make or break point with this guy. Because I know now we're playing the game. And it's not necessarily him, it's just the game. That's what you do. You play the game. So we sit down at our little table, and he pulls out the calculator, and he starts playing with numbers. And that's the big part of the game, is the playing with the numbers. one of the things they're going to try to do, and don't fall into this trap. Do not, whatever you do, fall into this trap, because they're going to ask you, well, how much are you willing to pay every month? That's the worst answer, the worst question you can answer, because what they'll do is they'll play with the numbers until they get to that monthly value. So in other words, what will happen is they'll say, well, here's what we'll do. How much can you pay a month? And they get you I can do about $450 a month. Okay. Well, if I could get you into that vehicle where you're only paying $450 a month, will you take it off the lot today? It's like, I don't know. Let's make a deal. Let's talk about it. I'm not going to say yes, I will get into it. Now, I understand why they want to have that confirmation out of you, because if they're going to do stuff to get to that price, they don't want to do all this work and then have you go, I don't really want it. You know, so I sort of understand why they're doing it, but at the same time, realize that nothing you do is binding. You can tell them, yes, I'll drive it off the lot today if you get to that. They get to it, and then you go, well, you know what, something, I just don't want it. And you're not binded into anything. So, you know, you can play the game backwards with them if you don't have a problem with giving your word and then breaking it. I'm not one of those people, though. I can't tell somebody something that's not true. And that's probably one of my biggest downfalls. I have to be truthful about stuff. So I'm not going to tell somebody that, yes, I will drive this off the lot if you get it to this money. And then them get it to that money, and then I'm not driving off the lot. Because that, to me, is my word. And my word, to me, is worth a lot. So that's something that I can't do, so I won't do that kind of thing. But one of the games they like to play as part of the game is to try to play with the numbers until you get the monthly payment that you're looking for, that you'll be happy with. So how do they do this? They do it by saying, okay, well, what if we were to have you pay X amount of dollars for the vehicle, we'll give you this much more for your trade-in, because, of course, not only are they going to start high on the vehicle that you're buying as far as the price goes, they're going to start low on your trade-in as well, because the lower they give you, the bigger that they're going to make a profit off of that when they sell it later on. So you got to realize that they're high on the price and low on the trade-in. And so what you need to do is you need to work with them to get those a little bit more favorable towards you. Now, at the same time, they're there to make a profit. So they're not going to give you top dollar necessarily and give you the price that they paid for on the vehicle, because they're not going to be making money. They need to make money. So you just got to figure out, how low can I get them? How much can I play the game? So what they'll do is they'll play with the numbers. Well, What if, and this is a big if, because, you know, I'm going to have to get this by the general manager, and, oh, geez, you know, I mean, I'm willing to do it for you, but it's going to be tough. But here, what if, and this is a big if, we could get him to give you this much for the trade-in and sell you it for this. We can get your monthly payment to $449. And a big smile erupts across his face. He's beat your $450 a month thing. You got your vehicle. You're happy. He's happy. Everybody's happy. But it's going to be a battle, but he's willing to fight it for you. He's willing to go in there and get yelled at for you. So then you say, well, okay, give that a shot. And then depending where you're at, some places will go ahead and sign this for me. Sign this piece of paper saying that you and I talked about this. So that way my general manager knows that you understand what's going on. And it's almost like that's their way of getting you to feel like you're now committing to something. That signature means nothing. You are not committing yourself to anything. But it's the psychological portion of it that is part of the game. So then he takes off and goes into some little room somewhere to the general manager, and they talk about whatever. You don't get to deal with the general manager directly. No. You deal with the car salesman, who then goes and deals with the general manager. And then he comes back to you. And it's part of the game. So he comes back to you and says, well, here's what we're able to do. And he slides a piece of paper in front of you. And it has certain values here, certain values there. And the bottom line is this. And it's $17 above what you wanted to do. Instead of $449, we're at $467. And, you know, it's so close. It's only $17 a month more. Only. And it's like, well, if it's only $17, why don't we knock $17 off and get it to only $450 a month? It's only $17 from your pocket. it's a little different story when you turn it that direction. But when it's coming from you, it's only $17. That's not so bad. So that's part of the game, though. That's what they play. Because what they're doing is they're going to play with the numbers until they get it as close to that bottom line, the monthly payment that you have said you're willing to pay. One of the ways they can do this, too, is they go from a 60-month loan to a 80-month loan. And what that does to you is all of a sudden, or an 82-month loan, and what that does to you is all of a sudden, or is it 84? What that does to you is it makes your interest that you pay expand. It makes the amount of money overall that you're paying on the vehicle more if they increase the number of months of your loan. But what they're doing is they're playing with numbers. They're not lowering the price of the car more. They're not increasing the trade-out more. They're playing with the numbers. So what they've done is they've said, okay, we're going to take this $40,000 that you are financing, and instead of dividing it by 60 months, we're going to divide it by 72 months, or we're going to divide it by 84 months. And what that does with your monthly payment is it might go from 490 down to 460 down to 450, and now we're at the point where you're willing to pay. But what have they done about the car? They haven't done anything about the prices of the car. They haven't done anything about what you're actually paying. You're still going to have to get a $40,000 loan because you're still paying $40,000, but your monthly payment is what has changed. Well, that's part of the game, and don't fall into that trap. If you fall into that trap, you've done nothing to help yourself. So here's what you have to do. You have to make it blatantly clear from the very beginning. It's not about what your monthly payment is. It's about how much you're going to owe at the end. And when I was doing this over in the Seattle area at the Dodge dealership there, the guy I was dealing with could not get that through his head. I said, I don't care what your monthly payment you get me is. I could care less because I'm going to be paying more than that monthly payment because I'm going to pay this truck off faster than a normal payment. So I don't care what it is. Well, what if I can get it $5 cheaper than this? I said, did you not hear what I just said? I don't care what my monthly payment is. I care about this bottom line, this amount that I'm going to owe to the bank in the end. That's the number I care about. Oh, okay. Well, what if we got it down to $440 a month? Like, did you not just understand the words that are coming out of my mouth? I don't care how much money I pay every month. I care about how much that bottom line is. Oh, what if I got it to $430 a month? I'm like, seriously, dude, I don't care if you get it to $1 a month. It's not going to make me buy this vehicle. What's going to make me buy the vehicle is what that bottom line figure is. How much money am I getting on the loan? Am I getting a $40,000 loan or am I getting a $38,500 loan? Because that's $1,500 of real difference. Not my monthly payment. Because you can take a 3-year car loan and turn it into an 8-year car loan, and you have decreased the amount of money you pay a month, but you've not decreased any of your debt load. And that's what you need to care about, is not your monthly payment, but your debt load, because they will do everything they can to get that car within your payment ability. It's not about your payment ability. It's about how much debt load you're willing to take on for that vehicle. And that's what you need to stay focused on. Don't play the game with how much they're going to get your monthly payment to be. What you need to do is play the game with how much am I going to take on in debt load. So that's the game you need to focus on, and that's the game you need to play. But they don't want to play that game. They don't want you to think about debt load. They don't want you to realize that, hey, my debt load's not going to change whether they make my monthly payment $450 or $440 or $430, because I'm still going to owe $40,000 at the very end. What you need to look at is, what are you going to owe? What is your bottom line going to be? So there you are. There's big part of the game, and don't fall into it. That's not the game you want to play. What you want to play is, what is good for me? What is going to be my bottom line? What am I going to pay at the very end? And that's what you need to fight for. And it is a fight. Let me tell you that. It is a fight. Like I said, that car dealer is not your friend at that very moment in time. He is out to make himself money. And that's not bad. That's a capitalistic system. But that's part of the capitalistic system, is that you get to negotiate. You get a barter for making the payments. You're making your overall payment, your $40,000, decreasing that to $38,500. And the question, and the thing you have to be willing to do, you must be willing to do, and I mean this with a big capital M-U-S-T, must be willing to do, is walk away. If you are unwilling to walk away, you will not, and I repeat, you will not be getting the best value. You must be willing to walk away. And what that means is this. You sit down with that car dealer after you've test driven your car. He tells you what he's willing to pay for your trade-in. He tells you what he's willing to go down to on the cost of the car. You see for yourself that it's going to be a $40,000 loan. Do you want that to be a $40,000 loan? Or would you rather it be a $38,000 loan or a $37,500? Would you rather a $37,500 loan or a $40,000 loan? Is it worth $2,500 to you to work to get it down? Maybe $2,500 to you is no big deal. Maybe you don't mind paying more money than what you need to. But if you want to get yourself the best deal, you must be willing to walk away. And the reason why I say that is, A, as I said earlier, there are other cars out there. There are other cars out there just like the one you're about to buy. That one car is not so unique that it's the only one like it in the world. I guarantee you there are others just like it with the exact same options, with the exact same colors, with the exact same everything. You don't have to buy that car. You can buy a different one. So be willing to walk away when things are not going favorably. Even if they seem to be going swimmingly, be willing to walk away. Because what will happen is, you will negotiate to a point, and you'll probably get to a point where you feel that they could come down a little bit more, but they're unwilling to. You probably feel, you know, I have a gut feeling that I should not pay this much money for the car. And if you have that feeling, you should be going with that feeling. If you feel like you're paying too much money for the car, you need to go with that gut feeling. You say, no, I want you to get this price lower. Not my monthly payments, because all you're going to do there is extend the term of my loan in order to make the payments smaller, but that doesn't reduce my debt load. I'm trying to get you to reduce my debt load, and what you need to do then is you need to be willing to walk away. You need to be willing to look at that and say, well, you know what? If you're able to get my bottom line out the door, after taxes, after everything, when it's all said and done, my loan will be $37,000 out the door. So in other words, you've essentially saved yourself $3,000. That will make you feel good about your purchase. So you say, out the door, I want to be $37,000 out the door. That's after I've paid taxes. That's after I've paid everything. It's not $37,000, then tax added onto it, which is going to get you almost up to that $40,000 again. No. I want out the door $37,000. So then, you have to be willing to stand by your guns, and you have to be willing to walk away. And if he is not able to get there, if he's not willing to play, what you do is you walk away. If you don't get to that value that you wanted, if you said $37,000 is where I need to be, you stay there and you keep working at it. If you don't get there, you walk away. If you do get there and that was the value you wanted to buy for $37,000 and you got there, hey, go ahead and buy it, because then you're happy about it. Or if you think, oh, geez, if I got the 37, I could probably get the 36, then you might play the game. But if you don't get to that $37,000 and you think it's reasonably able to be done, if you reasonably believe that they're not giving you a good enough value on your trade-in, and if you reasonably believe that there is room for them to come down from the amount of money they're asking for the vehicle, play the game. And this is how you play the game. You are in the driver's seat in this whole thing. You are the one in control, because you're the one who has to sign for the loan. And you know what? They are not the only car dealership in the world. And that is not the only car that is just like that. There is another car like that somewhere else at another dealership who might be very willing to give you a better deal. And they know that. The problem is they need you to buy it while you're there. They don't want you to walk out the door, because if you walk out the door, the chances of you then buying it go down dramatically. So what needs to happen is they need to get it before you walk out the door. That transaction needs to be made. So what you do is you play the game. You say, I'm sorry, and you walk away. They may or may not at that time go, okay, well, let me try this other angle. I thought of an idea that might work with my boss or whatever. But I guarantee what will happen if they don't chase you down right then, first thing in the morning, you will be getting a phone call, whether it's from the general manager or whether from the dealer, saying, hey, you know what? I talked to the GM last night, or, you know, he decided that we need to make this car sale happen. We're trying to get our numbers high for this month because of this reason. They'll come up with any reason in the world why they're able to now give you a better price that they weren't willing to do the day before. But they will get you back there. They will call you up and they will get you into that car, and they will come closer to what you're wanting to do. But remember, you have that power, and you will get a call the next day. Case in point is a friend of mine that I helped purchase his car. I knew the game now. I knew how to play the game. Plus, I had a little ally. A friend of mine was actually a used car salesman in Idaho, over in Moscow. And I was able to get all sorts of information from him about the game. He gave me the insights of the game. He's no longer a car salesman. That's probably why he told me some of these secrets. He told me about the game. And he said, one of the things he said is, you will never, ever, 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 with one more ever in there, go to a car dealership and buy the car the same day you look at it. Ever. Don't do it. Do not do it. If you want to get a good deal. If you're worried, if you think that that car is one of a kind because it has whatever, and you're worried it's going to get sold out from under you, you might be willing to pay too much money. You have to be willing to let that car go, and that's the big thing, is you have to be willing to let that car go. The problem I had with my friend is he was so scared about losing this vehicle that he was almost willing to sign that day. And I said, and the first rule is you do not buy the car that day. My friend told me this exact stuff. He said, well, this is what you need to do. Go and negotiate this, figure this out about the monthly payments, figure this out about the loan that you're getting. Because I even asked the guy when he said, okay, yeah, here's a loan we were able to find for you. I said, well, and it was sort of funny. I was sort of the proxy negotiator for my friend. My friend sort of just sat back and I did the negotiation. I said, well, how much of that loan percentage there is added on for yours? And he goes, oh, none of it. I'm like, you could get up to 3%. He goes, no, not in Idaho. You can only get 0.75%. I was like, really? My friend's a used car salesman here in Idaho, and he told me you can get up to 3%. Well, none of it. This is exactly what they're offering. I'm not taking any percentage above it. You know, and it's like, so if he's going to sit here and lie to me and then try to get me to believe him. And then he had lied to me about a few other things, too, along the way that, you know, I was able to confirm that they weren't necessarily truthful. One of the things was that car had been sitting on the lot for 90 days. My friend was afraid it was going to get sold out from under. I'm like, dude, it's been here for 90 days, 3 months. I doubt it's a hot commodity. They want to sell it as badly as you want to buy it. The biggest thing, though, is that you need to make them think they want to sell it worse than you want to buy it. Because it's the whole supply and demand. If that's the car you want, and they're the supplier, and you have the demand, that means they can make the price higher. You need to make it feel like you don't have a huge demand for the car, and they're going to have to lower the price to meet the area that you're willing to buy it at. So, we negotiated for quite a while. We got to an impasse, and finally my friend was ready to sign. And I'm like, and I grabbed him. And he wanted to buy it right on the spot. I said, no, we're going home. But we are going home. Get in my truck. Let's go. And I pretty much had to pull him out of the office, and we walked away from the deal. It was really hard for him to do because he really wanted that vehicle. He had his mind set on buying that vehicle. And I said, no, we're not going to do it. So the next morning, first thing in the morning, he got a phone call from the car dealership. He didn't answer the phone because he wanted me to be a part of what was going on. And then maybe an hour later, the phone rings again, and there it is. It's the car dealership again. They really want to get a hold of him. Well, he still doesn't answer the phone until I'm with him. Finally, I meet up with him. We go back to the car dealership. Hey, we got a little bit more money out of the deal now. The debt load was a little bit lower. Everything's working out a little better for the friend, so he goes ahead and buys the vehicle. So that is the game, and you've got to be willing and ready to play the game. And the rules for you as the game player are knowing. You have to absolutely 100% in your mind and heart understand and know that you are going to get a better deal if you were to, you can get a better deal if you were to be willing to walk away. Just a second here. KZUU, you're on the air. Hello. Okay, I guess they don't want to talk. I was hoping they had some input on this whole car thing. So anyway. So, be willing to walk away. Be willing to understand that that is not the only car in the world, that there could be other cars out there, and that you have to be willing to, you have to be willing to go to find another car. Do not settle on the car that you're going to buy. KZUU on the air. Okay. Well, whoever it is probably isn't listening to the show right now. Otherwise, he'd know that I'm going to be putting him on the air every time he calls in. Because I'm not going to stop my show in order to talk to him on the phone. Anyway, so be willing to walk away. That is probably the number one biggest rule. And equally as high as that one is be understand that there's another car just like that somewhere else. And that you can buy it somewhere else. Be willing to walk away. Be willing to understand that there is another car just like that somewhere else, and you could buy it somewhere else. You don't have to buy it at the car dealership. Also, do not play the number game. Do not play the, well, what if I can get you to this monthly payment game? Because they will get you to that monthly payment game, and you've done nothing to help yourself. All you've done is you've extended the term of your loan. So be ready to walk away from that kind of thing, too. Just be strong about saying, no, I care about the bottom line. I want to know how much I'm going to add to my debt load. And remember that you are probably going to get upside down in your car, especially if you buy a brand new car. If you buy a brand new car, expect to be upside down in that car unless you are willing to put money down on a car. And that's going to be something very important to do. KZUU on the air.
Scotty, are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you doing? Hello? Hello? Are we on the air? Okay, I guess...
Hey, Scotty.
Hey. How you doing? Hey, just a second. I'm gonna go to a song right now, and then we'll go ahead and get back to the caller and try to figure out why he's not talking on the air.